one case, the estate of Michael Maurer versus Steve and Renata Hill, and concerning, or at least an intervener, Hubert J. Hill. Before I start my normal record, this case has sort of grown like Topsy since the original briefs were filed and closed. There's before us are our guest consolidated appeals of one, the first one being the merits of the underlying case, the second one being a dispute about the calculation and imposition of prejudgment interest, and the third being problems or issues relating to a bond and pledge of property to secure that bond. That matter involves the interveners, and I don't know if they're here separately. We'll get to that and want to argue. It's been suggested by one member of the panel that we expand the arguments to 20 minutes. I know none of you came prepared to talk for 20 minutes, but I think we may be able to help you with that and fill in some of your time. And I want to know, I guess, at the outset, how you want to divide the time, and that primarily relates to the appellant side of the house. Or what? No, it doesn't either, because the intervener is sort of aligned with the appellee.
Your Honor, I'm Michael Martin, and I'm the attorney for the intervener, Hubert Hill. My clients are also pretty much aligned with the appellant.
That's right. I'm sorry. I'm getting lost in my own rhetoric. Do you intend to argue?
Mr. Sargent and I have discussed that. I think we're going to cede our time to Mr. Sargent.
Can I ask one question before our argument starts?
Well, yeah.
Does your client have standing to raise his client's claim?
Well, of course, standing issue has not been raised yet. Honestly, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there is precedent from this court, for example, the 1998 case of Ray, say, Milstein, where an adult child was able to put forth the interests of an elderly parent. I guess I would say we certainly have an interest to the extent that we were denied our stay. We were certainly injured to the extent that the supersedious bond was initially accepted, then rejected, and then there was execution on the appellant's property.
But as I understand it, you are not appealing the ultimate denial of the stay. The appeal has to do is the failure to vacate the deed of trust.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to ask.
Well, but all you're doing is arguing his position. You're not necessarily representing him in that sense.
That's correct.
Okay. So you don't need to divide time here, no need to divide time here. 20 minutes, 10 minutes, 40 minutes total argument. If you don't need to use it all, if you really don't need to, but it's available to you. Now let me make my more normal record. Argument has been set for 20 minutes per side in this case. The parties may use that time any way they wish. We would advise you that we have all read the briefs, some of the authorities cited in the briefs. One of us has been into the record to a considerable extent. We think we understand the facts and the cited law that has been given to us prior to the argument. So we would recommend that you go directly to the legal matters and not spend a great deal of time on the facts, except as you may think it's absolutely essential to support your argument. The appellant may reserve time for a rebuttal. That time, you should let me know how much you want, if you want me to help you with that effort. There is a module on the lectern that will give you your remaining time continuously. There are also lights that will be green during the first 15 minutes of the argument, I think. I yellow during the next 5 minutes, and red when the argument's over. But if you want me to give you a high sign or signal for your reserve time, I'd be happy to do that. The lectern is adjustable for height by toggle switches on your right. If you find it uncomfortably high or low, please adjust it. There's a microphone on the lectern, the purpose of which is to amplify the argument, but also to record it. We digitally record the arguments. We sometimes use those recordings in the process of the preparation of an opinion. So we would appreciate your staying at or very near the lectern so that we can clearly pick up your voice in the recording. In addition, you should know that the argument will be on the internet, posted on the court's website, certainly by the end of this week, but I would guess within a day or two of the argument. So if you want to relive it, you're free to do so. But more importantly, we're involved here with businesses, and I don't know if there's anything that one would want to keep confidential, but if there's any information about businesses you want to keep confidential, I would suggest you not mention it in the argument because it will be public knowledge by the end of the week. And lastly, but perhaps not leastly, we'd appreciate it if anyone who has an electronic device that will ring or make unusual noises unexpectedly to please turn them off or at a minimum put them on silent. And if you have to respond to them, to leave the room before you do so, so as not to disturb either counsel or the court in the course of the argument. Are there any questions? Pardon? 20 minutes per side, but that includes whatever you want to say about the bond. Okay. Five minutes. I will assist you in that endeavor, and we're ready, sir.
May it please the court, I'm Walter Sargent. I represent the appellants, Steve and Renata Hill. In March 2007, the Hills sold their auto body shop business and street rod business to Mike Marr, who operated the businesses until his death. The primary issue on appeal is whether the trial court erred in ordering rescission, including the return of all money paid by Mike Marr with no offset for value conveyed by the Hills. Now, as we've discussed in two later rulings, there was a ruling about prejudgment interest that we contend was erroneous, and there was a ruling about a supersedious bond. I am prepared to answer questions about those in expectation this would be only 15 minutes. I have not prepared particular remarks on those issues. There are four points that I want to make about the order of rescission. First, as a matter of law, the sale was not unconscionable. Second, the sale was not induced by fraudulent non-disclosure or fraudulent or negligent misrepresentation. Third, the contract did not lack essential elements or contractual intent. And fourth, the remedy of rescission without offset was contrary to law. I'd like to turn first to unconscionability. The trial court said that the consideration for this contract was, quote, so one-sided as to be unconscionable as a matter of law. But a finding of unconscionability requires more than one-sided consideration. It requires proof of overreaching resulting from unequal bargaining power or other circumstances in which there's a lack of meaningful choice. Here, there's no finding and no evidence that Mike Marr lacked meaningful choice. He was a sophisticated businessman. He made an unsolicited offer for two businesses that he knew were failing, losing a lot of money, were probably going to be shut down. He negotiated purchase terms for months. He was permitted to manage those businesses for 2 months on a day-to-day basis with full access to the premises, the assets, the company records, the computer system, the employees. He had his own CPA and he had his own small army of attorneys. In contrast, the Hills had no CPA, they had no attorneys, they were struggling both financially and physically. They essentially had the option of shutting down or selling. So who had the superior bargaining power and who had no meaningful choice? And even if one were to assume that the contract was both procedurally and substantively unconscionable, the right to be relieved from an unconscionable contract is lost by way of acquiescence. Here, Mike Marr didn't merely acquiesce in this contract. He took over the businesses and operated them for almost half a year until his death. So his right, if he had a right to rescission on grounds of unconscionability, was lost. Now, the estate speculates that the trial court, this determination of unconscionability had something to do with what it refers to as diminished mental capacity of Mike Marr. And the estate points to the fact that Mike Marr engaged in numerous criminal acts. He was a drug abuser. He was a spendthrift. And there may have been deep psychological reasons for his conduct, but the estate has offered no legal authority for providing criminals and drug abusers and spendthrifts with a special right of rescission that permits them to also keep everything that they've purchased.
What about if he had a diminished mental capacity, what about the Hills taking advantage of that? Wouldn't that be a form of overreaching?
The one finding that the trial court made as to his mental capacity or competency was that his outward appearance was that he had competency, and all the evidence was to that effect.
Is outward appearance the controlling standard here? Or is it, you know, competency in fact?
Well, the plaintiff raised his competency, and that was one of the bases for rescission, and the trial court rejected that. And the only medical testimony in this case was from Mike Marr's family physician, who said that he had no questions about his competency. He acknowledged that he had a dependency on prescription drugs. But the evidence from his divorce attorney, his transactional attorneys, his CPA, everybody who worked with him, was that there was no indication of any lack of confidence.
Well, everybody was somewhat shocked by the terms of the transaction in terms of paying 1.9 less than 20% discount for a business that lost that money, lost $1.5 million in the last 2 years. The purchase price is based not on the value of the business, but on the losses.
No, Your Honor, the purchase price was based on the amount that the Hills had lent to the two companies.
Which was to cover losses.
Well, that's correct, in part, yes. And to start up the businesses. They had only been in effect for 2 or 3 years. So, they were startup companies. I'd like to turn, if I may, to what to me is perhaps the most disturbing aspect of this case, because it impugns the integrity of two, I think, very decent people. And that's the court's holding that Stephen Renata Hill were liable for fraudulent nondisclosure and fraudulent and negligent misrepresentation. Now, to establish fraudulent nondisclosure, the estate had to prove that the Hills failed to disclose a material fact that they had a legal duty to disclose. They did so with the intent to deceive, and that Mike Marr justifiably relied on that non-disclosure. Here, the court's only finding was that there was no disclosure of the types and reasonable value of the assets purportedly being sold. Well, first of all, even if that's true, what legal duty would that violate? The contract.
What was Mr. Maurer buying? Was he buying the corporations, the shares in the corporation, in which case I might agree with you that the value of the underlying assets, the tools and all that, is irrelevant because you're buying a corporation that has fixed and non-fixed assets, goodwill and not goodwill. But was he buying the assets or the corporations?
He was purchasing the assets. He did that on advice of counsel to avoid any liabilities.
Then why wouldn't we expect them to get a list of the assets he's buying?
He did get a list. He got a list of over 150 items, and that's Exhibit N.
What did the court mean then when it said, you know, they didn't give him a, you know, list of the types, not just the reasonable values, but the types of assets?
Your Honor, I have no idea what the court meant by that.
How about either the non-disclosure or the misrepresentation that one of the listed items would be theirs, would be Mars?
There was out of those 150 plus items, there was one. There were several that were written in by hand, and one was a trailer. And the testimony of Steve Hill was that Mike Marr didn't want that listed, and he took it off, and they both knew that. And there's no evidence whatsoever that Mike Marr thought that he was going to get that trailer. And that was not, by the way, included in the valuations. There was a list of valuations of many of the items, and that wasn't included in that.
Wasn't part of the deal also that he was to buy the real estate?
No, Your Honor. That was a separate one-page document that was signed the same day that specified that he would purchase the real estate for, I believe it was market value or appraised value. But that never came to fruition. So I want to make clear, I mean, there were two different contracts. I guess the answer is yes, there was a contract to do that, but it never came to fruition.
And certainly it was contemplated that he would.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. As it turned out, there was a monthly rental of, I think it was $9,800 per month from Mike Marr to the Hills, renting approximately $20,000 of 20,000 square feet of space.
Let me ask you about the reasonable values part of the court's findings. Two things. First is the question, you say no authority of a duty to disclose reasonable values. But what about when someone does disclose a value? Must it be accurate?
I think if it's represented to be a reasonable value, then it should be a reasonable value. The Exhibit N.
Is there any evidence that it was inaccurate, the reasonable values?
No, there was no evidence that there were any values given, reasonable or otherwise. The Exhibit N, as I say, is a list of about 150 assets, and next to most of those, there is a statement clearly identified as cost. It was a running ledger of assets of these companies. And it was simply updated and turned over to Mike Marr.
Was there on the balance sheets or an entry for assets? I mean, for these tools, I gather these assets, and I haven't looked at the record, are tools and equipment used in the business and inventory.
And inventory,
there was
yes,
any
Your
inventory.
Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Are those carried in the records of the business, separate items, inventory and tools and equipment?
Well, they were, as I say, I mean, they were. This list was on the computer records. I have to say, I assume that they were part of the balance sheets, but I
can't
say. Well,
he was given balance sheets, was he not?
Yes, yes, Your
Honor. Assets and liability.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that is a value. It may not be an itemized value, but
and not necessarily a reasonable value, and they never purported to be. In other words, they were set forth on this itemization as cost.
Can I get you to shift to your third argument, and that is whether there was a contract at all?
Yes, Your Honor.
The court's ultimate conclusion was there was no contract, and I would gather, without knowing for sure, that there's evidence to support that from the accountant, from the attorneys who were representing Mr. Maurer and others, that this was an ongoing discussion and didn't actually result in a contract. Now, I appreciate there's a contrary point of view to that, but the court found there was no contract.
Not precisely, Your Honor. The court found that there was no enforceable contract.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mr. Sargent. I thought the court found that in the first instance, they did not intend the first document to be a contract, and the second instance would not be a contract because of the lack of definite terms.
Right, and we don't disagree with the latter, and the issue is whether the one-page document was, in fact, the party's contract.
Right, but didn't the court find that there was no intent that it be a contract, so it actually said no contract?
It was clear to the court that it was not intended to be their contract,
right?
And so whether that meant their final contract or what, but if Your Honor's suggesting that this is subject to a clearly erroneous standard of review, I'd just like to say that this court can read this document as well as the trial court could. And it clearly states that it shall serve as the purchase agreement for these two companies. Clearly identifies the sellers and the buyer.
Okay, counsel, let's assume that it's internally consistent, identifies what's going to be sold, identifies the price, identifies how the price is going to be paid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if they signed it, as I understand the trial court found, perhaps with support in the record, that they did not intend this to be the contract, doesn't that mean it's not a contract?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have the particular case, but the parties themselves, after signing this document, treated it as their contract. And Mike Marr, first of all, of course, he made the down payment, signed the promissory note.
What do we do with that? The trial court didn't address that. I appreciate you can make an argument based upon subsequent conduct that a contract in fact existed. Matter of fact, you might be able to make an argument based upon the conduct of the parties that a contract existed without the document.
Okay, yes,
you might
Honor.
Have a hard time proving all the terms, but
that's correct, Your Honor.
One of the parties did, but nonetheless, you could do that.
I agree, Your Honor.
The court made no findings with respect to that. What are we to do with that?
Your Honor, I believe it can be determined as a matter of law that there was a contract here. In fact, at the receivership hearing, Mike Marr repeatedly stated, and that's Exhibit 1A, repeatedly stated that the one-page sale agreement was, in fact, the party's contract. He specifically said that was the sale of assets. So that was an admission by Mike Marr.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel. What if we looked at it and said, there's conflicting inferences as to whether or not the parties intended or didn't intend at that time that it be a contract? Are we free to give legal effect to undisputed facts in the record regarding Mr. Maurer's takeover of the company for 4 months or several months?
I believe so, Your Honor, especially in light of Mr. Maurer's admission under oath that he had a contract and this was the contract.
He admitted under oath?
At the receivership hearing.
Okay. You're at 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Your Honors, my name is Craig Fleischman. I represent the estate, which is the appellee. You raise some very pointed questions, and I think that they come to the heart of the matter. Clearly, the trial court determined that there was no enforceable contract. There was no meeting of the minds, and also, in essence, indicated that if there was a contract, it was so tainted by unconscionability or misrepresentation that it was not enforceable. If I could focus for...
What was misrepresented? I haven't read the whole record, but I cannot find any misrepresentations. It seems that the seller gave the buyer access to all the records of the corporation, and there's nothing where there was a misrepresentation that I know about, but you've just said that there was a misrepresentation, and what was that?
There was, Judge Nay. We referenced in our briefs, we compared various balance sheets of the same day provided to Mr. Maurer, which had hundreds of thousands of dollars in discrepancies between the amount of or value of the assets and the value of the liabilities. The tax returns were not furnished to Mr. Maurer, and the tax returns also had hundreds of thousands of dollars of difference.
They weren't finished. How do we know then they had hundreds of thousands of dollars? Were they furnished subsequently to Mr. Maurer?
Well, one, the various internal financial documents, the balance sheets and profit and loss statements, sir, were exhibits at trial. And we presented to the trial court that at the end of 2006, for example, here were different balance sheets prepared by Mr. Hill or his staff, and on the same date, these different balance sheets had dramatically different disclosures.
Are you suggesting that Mr. Maurer didn't see the tax returns, but they became available later?
Yes, sir. And that was the testimony, that the tax returns were not provided to him.
What about the differences in the financial documents that were provided to him? Why wouldn't that have put him on inquiry notice as to, maybe I better get these things appraised? Maybe I better get some independent appraiser in here?
I think that is kind of a collateral issue, a red herring sort of issue. And the reason I say that, sir, is given the fact there was no contract that was ever formulated between the parties, at the end of the day, whether he was on inquiry notice or not doesn't make a lot of difference. But there was testimony, sir, which supports our position related to the unconscionability issue that was raised about unequal bargaining power and the diminished, let's call it diminished mental capacity of Mr. Maurer.
Wouldn't there have to be evidence that the Hills were aware of Mr. Maurer's diminished capacity? In other words, to overreach and have unequal bargaining power?
No.
Why?
Because I don't think there's any case law whatsoever which supports the fact that if I have diminished mental capacity, that unless you know that I am, let's call it mentally incompetent, just to go to the extreme, that because you don't know it, somehow a contract arises. It can. The issue is, in essence, related to me, the infirm party, not whether you know it or not. And remember, we did plead fraudulent misrepresentation as well as negligent misrepresentation, so we didn't have to get to intent. And intent also, if we're looking at the elements of fraud, also includes a reckless disregard. And if we look at the reality of the situation, Mr. Hill is supposedly telling Mr. Maurer and telling his family, I'm going to shut down this business in September of 06. It's a worthless business. And in the 3 years that SSR, Strictly Street Rods, was in existence, 04 to 06, it lost $1 million. The 1 year that Golden Collision was in existence, it lost $400,000. So in this three-year time frame, these two businesses lost $1.4 million.
Businesses frequently lose money in their youth, then make it up in their maturity. These businesses were all fairly new businesses. That doesn't necessarily mean there's no optimism. I realize the sellers didn't apparently have much optimism, but that doesn't mean there couldn't be optimism that these businesses would ultimately be successful.
One could theoretically have optimism, but certainly the individuals who created these two businesses were beyond pessimistic. They had gone to
What is the evidence that there's no contract?
Okay, here's the evidence. In the world of possibilities, Judge Roy, in the world of possibilities, there's only two documents that could possibly be a contract. The 37-page draft asset purchase agreement prepared by Rothgerber Apple Powers, and the second document, which is the one-page sale agreement. If we look at the asset purchase agreement, which Mr. Hill testified was not a contract,
The long one or the short one?
That's the 37-pager.
Okay, the long one was not a contract.
Mr. Hill testified to that, and it was undisputed. And in fact, you saw in the opening brief by the appellant, as well as the reply brief, they say that the asset purchase agreement was not viable. It didn't have a purchase price. It didn't have payment terms. The 30 schedules that were supposed to be completed by the seller, none were completed. There were seller and buyer obligations. None were completed. A bill of sale was never prepared. A listing of assets to be transferred was never prepared. Clearly, the essential terms weren't there. And in addition to that, William Nelson, an attorney with Rothgerber, testified that he believed that the sales agreement, the one-pager, was in essence, I'm paraphrasing, a letter of intent, a conceptual document. It was not the contract between the parties.
And what supports that opinion?
What supports William Nelson's opinion?
Yeah.
Well, the fact that his firm charged thousands of dollars to prepare a draft of an asset purchase agreement, that he was still preparing documentation after the purported March 1 closing. In fact, he was still preparing documentation related to an asset purchase agreement in June. Now, we all know, the three of you and I, we all know there's two ways and only two ways that you can really sell, transfer assets associated with a business. You either have an equity type sale where you're selling the stock or the units, depending on the organizational structure, or you have an asset purchase agreement. If you read closely the one-page sales agreement, it's not an asset purchase sale. It is a, quote, sale of businesses, close quote. Everybody admits that this was not a business sale. Roth Gerber charged thousands of dollars to draft an asset purchase agreement.
That was insufficient.
That was insufficient. And what happened, sir?
How about viewing the both of the documents together? Would that be a contract? Should the court have considered that?
Well, I don't think the court could, because look at the terms that are missing from both documents. Beyond the fact that the sales agreement, the one-page sales agreement, deals with the sale of businesses, which is obviously a different concept conceptually than from an asset purchase, because in one you're acquiring liabilities and the other you're not. In addition, the sales agreement talks about three payments of X amount and nine payments of X amount of money. There's no indication when those payments are to begin or when they're to end, an essential element. Another thing which I think is really, really essential to the formulation of a contract, vis-a-vis what we see in the sales agreement, is the fact that it says that the assets and inventory located at the business are going to be part of the sales transaction. It doesn't say as of when. Now, Mr. Sargent indicated to you that an inventory list was made up in February. There was absolutely no testimony that in March or April or May or June, the inventory list that was created in February still existed in that exact form when the closing occurred. Well, you say to me, well, when was the closing? I don't know the answer. You cannot find in the asset purchase agreement, which everyone says is not a contract, or the sales agreement, when the closing is supposed to occur. And in addition to that, if you were going to buy something from me, whether, Judge, you were going to buy my car or my house or whatever, presumably, if you're buying an asset from me, don't you want a bill of sale? And part of the unconscionability of it all is there's no bill of sale. There's no legal transfer of anything of value, nor is anything specifically identified.
Let me ask you this, counsel.
Yes, sir.
In Mr. Sargent's brief, he cites to a case that says, gee, if the party acts as if there's a contract, then later on the party is stopped from denying the existence of the contract. And what about all the evidence here that Maurer is paying the down payment, taking the promissory note, taking control of the premises, running the businesses as if there were a contract? Seems undisputed that's his conduct.
Well, it might be that he had conduct which was consistent with someone who thought he had a contract, but none of us can declare that there is a contract if the essential elements are not there.
We're back to the first point I wanted to ask you about.
Yes, sir.
A person who acts as if there's a contract, whether there is or not, is a stop from claiming there isn't a contract. That's what the authority that Mr. Sargent cites. What kind of response to that authority is there?
Well, the authority exists that the legal element or legal case exists in the world of possibilities as far as estoppel is concerned. But there was not any argument, sir, any argument whatsoever at the trial court, and of course you're bound by the record, that a contract arose by estoppel. They presented to the trial court the sales agreement is the contract. And none of us, especially not me at the Court of Appeals level, can start arguing whether there are facts to support estoppel or not when the whole case was framed by the appellant and the appellee in the trial court as a singular issue. The sale agreement was the contract.
Is there any indication in the record in the trial court's comments, if he made a bench ruling? I've read his written ruling, and I don't find it. At his finding, there was no enforceable contract included not only that document, but the subsequent conduct?
I think that the subsequent conduct supports that there was no contract. Specifically...
Is there anything in the record that would indicate the court considered the subsequent conduct in determining that there was no enforceable contract?
Yes, sir. I believe there is, and if I can point out to what I believe it is.
Okay.
Your Honor might recall that one of the principal witnesses at the time of trial was William Nelson of the Rothgerber firm. Mr. Nelson testified that based on his interaction, his conversations with Mr. Maurer, he believed that this, quote, sales agreement was, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting, in essence akin to a letter of intent. It was conceptual, that sort of thing. And it was his understanding that what Mike Maurer hired the Rothgerber firm to do was to put together a contract. And the fact that the Rothgerber firm drafted a 37-page asset purchase agreement, which they hadn't completed, and they were still asking Mr. Maurer for documentation up to the point in time when he blew his brains out, presumably because of his drug addiction and depression, that the very actor of hiring the Rothgerber firm and painted thousands of dollars to create an asset purchase agreement is consistent with our position that Mr. Maurer was not treating the sales agreement as a contract.
Is there anything in the record to support the proposition, and I appreciate that Mr. Maurer was not there, to support the proposition that his taking possession of the businesses was merely for inspection and trial as opposed to operating it actually as his responsibility?
Yes, sir.
What is that evidence?
Well, the evidence was that he was paid a salary during that roughly January through March time frame. And as a salaried employee, he was running the business. Mr. Hill testified that he was stressed, he was burned out, that his main office was at another one of his businesses at a different location called 5R, and he left to Mr. Maurer the operation of this other business.
What about after March? Was he paid a salary then?
I'm sorry, sir.
What about after March? Was he paid a salary then?
He paid himself a salary, but he didn't pay himself a salary from either Golden Collision or strictly Street Rods. If you look, sir, at the last page of the base part of that 37-page asset purchase agreement, which is page 34, the asset purchaser is listed as Golden Collision and Paint, Inc. Now, you don't see that entity on the sale agreement, so clearly, and this goes to the estoppel issue, intent, that sort of thing, clearly it was Mike Maurer's intent that he would not be an individual purchaser of the assets. It would be his new company, Golden Collision and Paint, Inc.
It was never formed.
It was formed, sir, approximately 7 days after the contract draft was created. And that, again, supports the fact that Mr. Maurer was asking the Rothgerber firm, Judge Roy, to incorporate this new business, Golden Collision and Paint, Inc. So it was clearly not his intent, as is argued by Mr. Sargent, related to the one-page sale agreement, that Mr. Maurer would individually be the purchaser.
Who put up the promissory note, Mr. Maurer or Golden Collision?
The promissory note was Golden Collision and Paint, but he guaranteed.
He guaranteed it, so that's no intent that he didn't individually mean to be on the line for that amount? And also, who paid the $800,000 or $800,000+?
Well, in essence, he stole it. What he did was...
Is that the Hill's fault?
Absolutely not. But it gets to the unconscionability issue, sir, the unequal bargaining power, the fact that this drug addict was arrested for forging his physician's signature, burglarizing the homes, forged his wife's signature on loan documents, stole pain medication from his son.
Counsel, I don't want you to go far afield. It seems to me this case turns on the issue of whether there was a contract or not. It seems to me that on the unconscionability, it's a lot thinner. And on the misrepresentation, it's a lot thinner. but on whether there was a contract is where I think it turns. And so that's why I'm asking you the questions I'm asking you and the ones I asked Mr. Sargent.
Understood.
Is there support in the record that other than through the testimony of others that no contract was intended by that one-page document, which is the only document anybody points to?
Well, I think, Judge Roy, there's a couple of ways you can come to that conclusion. You could come to that conclusion based on the testimony of Mr. Nelson of the Rothgerber firm, that was not the intent of the parties. You can look at the one-page sale agreement and say the essential elements are not there related to what assets, what inventory is going to be transferred, what assets and inventory as of when, existing as of when, the fact there's no bill of sale, the fact that if the parties contemplated an asset purchase agreement, Mr. and Mrs. Hill were the only people on their side, so to speak, to sign that one-page agreement. They owned nothing. It was Golden Collision and Strictly Street Rods who owned the assets. The Hills were incapable of transferring anything.
Who owned those companies?
What difference does it make? I have a share of General Motors. It doesn't mean that because I am one of the owners of General Motors that I have the ability to transfer General Motors assets.
Would it mean anything if you were the only owner of General Motors?
No, because the reason, sir, as you well know, that corporations are set up, I should say, not the reason, but one of the reasons, is to insulate, to protect the owners from liability. If what could happen is what you said, that the owner could treat, 100% owner, could treat that entity as its alter ego, then one of the purposes for creating a corporation fails.
You're down to 1 minute. Now, why don't you address briefly the issue of the deed of trust?
Okay. I would be happy to do that.
You apparently would like to have that deed of trust remain in effect, assuming the judgment survives appeal.
Yes, sir.
On what basis do you think that remains in effect?
Okay. So this is not a situation where a judgment debtor has posted property and there's an issue associated with going to or attacking that judgment debtor. What happened was Mr. Steve Hill's father, Hubert Hill, voluntarily came in essence to the trial court and said, I offer you this deed of trust. And one of you mentioned the issue, I believe it was you, Judge Royce, of estoppel.
Let's assume as a fact happened, the stay is ultimately dissolved.
Okay.
Does that property remain available to you as a creditor?
It does in this sense, sir. The trial judge, Judge Munsinger, after multiple motions by the appellant to reduce the number of parcels of property, the real property, to be pledged, and having lost it there, and then went to the Court of Appeals and asked this court to reduce the number of properties that would be pledged after the deed of trust issue. And after you denied it, then Judge Munsinger said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep this deed of trust, or these deeds of trust, as security, which were voluntarily recorded by the Hills, not by the court, and I'm going to put
it. There's no state of execution.
There is a state. That's incorrect, sir. There is a stay. Judge Munsinger ordered that we could not levy against any of the deed of trust property. So for the...
But you can go and execute against everything else the Hills may have.
That's right.
Well, why would you be able to execute against the Hubert Hills property if Hubert Hill basically said no stay of execution against the Hills, I want my property back? How do you get to execute against someone who's not a judgment debtor?
Well, I'll give you an example that happens every single day, sir. When there's a judgment against an individual or an entity, and the trial court, in essence, says, if you want to stay, you got to post a bond. And I come into court, and I say to Judge Munsinger, I've got Bank of America, who has pledged a letter of credit. Bank of America isn't the judgment debtor. And Judge Munsinger says, okay, I will accept the letter of credit from Bank of America. Is there any case whatsoever in Colorado, I couldn't find one in the country, where after a third party, such as Bank of America, has pledged a letter of credit and it's been accepted by the court and a stay entered, that Bank of America comes back and says, you know, I changed my mind, I want my letter of credit back?
No, that's not the question. The question is, assuming that the appellant is unsuccessful on appeal.
Yes, sir.
That's what the stay was for, pending
yes,
appeal.
Sir.
And Bank of America puts up a letter of credit.
Mm-hmm.
Is Bank of America obligated to pay the judgment?
Yes.
That's my understanding also.
Yes. And I'm saying the same thing.
I took you over time about 3 minutes.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. I don't know what to do for you, Mr. Sergeant. I suppose we can add a minute to your time if you... Can you add a minute to Mr. Sergeant's time? I'm not seeing it yet. I can keep track of it on the watch. Go ahead. Start the clock. Go ahead.
I want to first address what I understood to be a sort of an argument of waiver about whether performance under the contract subsequent to contract would. Okay. At volume 3 of the trial court transcript, pages 50 to 51, on the motion for judgment following the close of plaintiff's evidence, defendant's counsel said, they went ahead, they exchanged the money, Mr. Marr signed the note, he took over the business, and that cured a wealth of deficiency that might have existed had this dispute arisen when there were documents signed but nothing had occurred. The issue of waiving the right to claim there was no contract was fully preserved. As for, again, I think, Judge Roy, your concerns about the existence of a contract, I want to stress we do have Mr. Marr's testimony right here in Exhibit 1A, and he repeatedly says it was the one-page document, and Mr. Fleischman's partner cross-examined him and said, you know, what did you pay all these Rothgerber attorneys for? How much did you pay? He says $5,600. And he comes back and he says again, no, it was the one pager. That was my contract.
Are you saying that's a binding judicial admission as opposed to consideration of conflicting evidence of Mr. Nelson's?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there is any conflicting evidence on the part of Mr. Nelson. The fact that Mr. Nelson might have believed that this document was something other than what it appears to be, I don't think is evidence.
Let me ask you this. It appears that Mr. Maurer's behavior subsequent to signing the one-page document was conflicting. On one course of conduct, he took possession, perhaps, of the business, operated the business as his own. And the other, he was still preparing a contract and still working on the deal. The deal was not complete. Now, if the court accepts the latter and not the former and holds that there's no enforceable contract, how do you avoid that conclusion?
Well, I think I'm a little unclear about the question, but I guess I want to first say I don't think there is conflicting evidence about this. I think the evidence shows that they signed this one-page document on March 1st, and the Rothgerber attorneys were doing a bunch of things, like setting up Mr. Marr's entities at that time. And in the course of that, they also put together this form contract that was incomplete. It was just a form.
It was a work in progress.
I suppose, but it was a work that never got completed. But again, and to answer Judge Daly's question, I think it is a judicial admission. It was under oath. I mean, it couldn't be clearer. And I also want to say the Colorado, Mr. Marr also filed documents for the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment, Exhibit F, where he stated under penalty of perjury that he had, in fact, bought the businesses of the Hills. I want to say a couple of other things about what Mr. Fleischman said. First, the tax returns were conveyed to Mr. Marr. At the first volume of the trial transcript, Sid Smith, who was the CPA for Mr. Marr, stated that he had reviewed the tax returns, and I was just surprised by that. As to the two different balance sheets, as we explained in our trial brief, in our reply brief, the second one that showed a higher amount of assets was actually prepared after Mr. Marr took over the business. It wasn't prepared by anybody while the business was still owned by the Hills. I want to make sure that there's time that if the court has any questions about anything.
I have a question. Was there any evidence in the record that any further documentation besides the one page and the asset purchase agreement were contemplated by the parties?
The promissory note.
No, okay. But I mean, is there any other evidence in the record that the law firm is continuing to work on yet further documents for the parties to sign in the next 3 or 4 months?
Other than the promissory note, which was apparently prepared by the Rothmüller firm, I'm not aware of anything.
Let's ask you about the bond.
Okay.
Assuming the judgment remains in place, is the surety on the bond, which happens to be the father, remain liable for the judgment?
No, I mean, it was not accepted as a supersedious bond. It was initially accepted before they had an opportunity to object. They objected. The trial court agreed with them, said, no, this isn't good enough. We want him to actually transfer title. And Mr. Hill said, I'm not going to do that. And you can't make me. And he was right. And they proceeded to execute on everything they could get their hands on. And
How can you keep security when you don't grant a stay? How can you require security when you don't grant a stay?
I don't see how you can. I mean, it was offered solely for the purpose of a stay of execution against his son and daughter-in-law so that they could proceed with their lives and their business. And that was the sole reason. And that was an exceptionally generous thing for him to do. But they can't then reject that and say, no, we want to go ahead and execute, and then, you know, if there's still something more, we'll take it from Mr. Hill.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the appellee rejected the security?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Rejected it as sufficient for supersedious bond and proceeded to execute. And perhaps they could have come back and said, well, you know, we'll take this as a security. We acted a little hastily. No, they proceeded to execute.
Well, gentlemen, it's gone a little bit more than 20 minutes. We thank you for your time. We thank you for your arguments. We thank you for your briefs, all of which were well presented. We will take the matter under advisement. The matter will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. And the bailiff may announce a recess subject to call.